Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast by radio amateurs with a focus on homebrew electronics. We get together on the internet to swap ideas about radio construction projects. Our website is www.soldersmoke.com. Please send feedback to soldersmoke, that's one word, at yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. All right, February 14, 2008, Solder Smoke 77. Good morning. I got the HWA playing in the background. You guys might hear it. I'm tuned to 80 meters, and I am on the air from Rome. I got to tell you guys, I am enthused. Restrictions that are placed on your operation lead to advantages. You got to make the best of a bad situation. I've been telling you about my small shack and about my the limits that our very urban Roman neighborhood have placed on my antenna creativity, but I have found a way to get on the air, and I tell you, it's exciting. It's gotten me back to QRP. I know you guys, some of you have probably been thinking that this started out as a QRP program. We advertise on QRPL, yet we've been talking about some projects that are really pretty far removed from the do more with less school of ham radio. Well, we're back to doing more with less here now, and I want to say that I think that we may have come up here at Italy 0/N2CQR with a new dimension to QRP. I know there's a lot of you out there that are using really, really low power transmitters. Michael Alpha Alpha 1 Tango Juliet is using all different kinds of diodes. He's recently shifted from tunnel diodes into Zeners and is transmitting with ridiculously low nanowatt and microwatt power levels. I'm not, my HW8, my Heathkit HW8 is definitely a high power transmitter when compared with Michael's rigs, but I gotta tell you, I think my rig might not be the lowest power transmitter, but my antenna is, I think, one of the lowest wire gauge antennas out there. I am operating now, get this, a 30-gauge wire, number 30 enameled wire from Radio Shack. Take a look in your junk box and pull some of that out. You'll see how thin it really is. It's I guess it's a bit thicker than hair, but not much. And I have discovered that it is, good thing for me, completely, almost completely invisible. I'll tell you about the evolution of the antenna. I think I described a little of this in the last show, but I determined that the best way for me to get access to the universe from this apartment was through a window completely on the other side of the apartment. So this required some coax to go through the living room, and like I said, duct tape across the floor, holding down the cable, RG8 would just it wouldn't go. So today is Valentine's Day, by the way. So you have to keep in mind kind of family responsibilities here. So I decided that wouldn't be a go. So I went out and I bought some of this cable TV coax, It's 75 ohm stuff with a white cover on it. It's got aluminum foil wire shield, copper center conductor with some sort of foam dielectric. Looked pretty good. I tacked it down around the wall of the living room and up and over and around a couple of doors and out to the window. And then very carefully, very discreetly, I lowered to the street a piece of 30-gauge wire. I had just a little little piece of metal tied onto the end, actually one of these hose clamps, a little tiny thing about the size of a quarter, just to weigh it down. And I lowered it carefully down to the street, avoiding any contact with the windows of the neighbors below. And then I hooked it up to the coax. At first I had the tuner, I had a little homebrew antenna tuner out there at the window, and I found that I could tune this thing up quite well, certainly on 20 meters, and that's what gave me my first contact with a G4 station on 20 meters about a week and a half ago. That was great, but I immediately figured that it would get real old if I had to move back and forth between the shack and the antenna window. Also, my homebrew antenna tuner it's got a big coil wound with bell wire wound on a pill bottle coil form with a couple of big air variable caps on it. It didn't really look good there on the windowsill in the living room. Again, there's that family responsibility kind of thing, domestic tranquility and all that. So anyway, I moved the tuner back into the shack, and now the rig goes to the tuner, the tuner goes to the coax, and my 30-gauge invisible wire is just connected to the center conductor of the coax. I don't know how this would model in EasyNIC or any of the other antenna modeling programs, but I'm telling you, it works real well. Now, let me tell you about a little kind of secret antenna operation I had to engage in here. You might be hearing the HW8 in the background there. An EA2 station there. Anyway, I wanted to get the obviously with the wire leaning right up against the building, that's not really the optimal situation. So I looked around, and there's a tree, little tree, kind of well positioned so that I could, if I got my little bit of wire over one of the top branches of the tree, it would pull the wire out from the building, and I'd have more of a sloping away from the building. So I had to do this very carefully. I went out early on, I guess it was last Saturday morning, and I'm walking along. I'm walking along the side of the building. I know exactly where the wire is, but where my wire is, I have to look for it because it's pretty hard to see. And I look around. I look over my shoulder. Uh-oh, somebody's walking their dog right there. Got to wait. Got to do another pass. Walk down to the end of the block. Look at my watch. Act like I forgot something. Start walking back in the other direction. Check up and down the street. The coast is clear. I grab that little hose clamp with the 30-gauge wire tied onto it. And in one shot, I threw that thing up and over the branches of the tree. So now my little vertical 30-gauge wire antenna has become a sloper. We're on the what you'd call in the States the fifth floor, so I guess I've got about 50 or 60 feet of wire out there, just sloping down into the tree. And with my little homebrew pill bottle antenna tuner, I could tune it up just fine on 80 meters, 40 meters, and 20 meters, and I've had contacts on all three of those bands. I haven't even checked 15. But I'm guessing that it would work fine on 15 meters with the HW8, and I've been having contacts with this thing just about every time I sit down in front of the rig. I've had about 7 or 8 contacts with it, contacts in the morning and the evening. I'm really pleased because I'm an early morning radio amateur. It's now 06:05 in Rome, local time. And I'm always here early in the morning, and it was kind of disheartening in Rome because the bands that I had antennas for were completely dead at the hour of the day that I was in the shack. So this was not good. But let me tell you, even at 4 o'clock in the morning here, the CW portion of the 80-meter band is just jumping. There is all kinds of activity there. Most of it is fanatical DXers chasing stations that I can't hear. But as the morning wears on and as we get around to 6 o'clock, there are actually people who are calling just CQ. Not, you know, with any restrictions. The good old-fashioned CQ, the genuine I'll talk to anybody who calls me kind of traditional CQ that we all grew up with. None of this CQDX, CQDX only. None of this CQ Asia Pacific. None of this CQ only for Kwajalein Island or any of that. It's just CQ. By the way, when they call CQDX over here, what that means is they don't want to talk to any European station. So you could be there could be some guy in Poland calling CQDX, CQDX, and if you give him a call from Italy or from the UK, very often you'll get kind of a nasty DX only response or something like that, which I really think is awful. I mean, how hard is it to give somebody a signal report? But anyway, on 80 meters in the morning here, right around this time, you'll find genuine CQ calls, and that's really, really great. So the HWA, it's just been great. I told you guys about my adventures in repairing it, and that repair, as I'm sure all of you know, really makes you it makes the use of the rig much more pleasing and much more significant. The thing is, with every repair, with every modification, the thing becomes less of an appliance and more like a homebrew rig. It's not a completely, of course, it's not the same kind of thing as using a completely homebrew piece of gear. But I found that for me, a good repair, especially if it involves a complicated problem and it involves some intricate troubleshooting, is almost as satisfying as building and putting on the air a completely homebrew piece of gear. Hey, this brings me to something I wanted to ask you guys about. You know, I told you that on the HW8, the problem that cropped up last week was with the keying transistor, Q11, on the HW8. It's just a pretty standard PNP transistor. And it went toes up on me. Now, the way it went bad, it didn't just suddenly go bad. It was intermittent bad for a day or so. Sometimes it would work, then it would stop working. What it was doing, it was this keying transistor is what it does is when you put the key down, it just puts VCC on the driver in the transmitter. And when the key is up, it's supposed to keep voltage off the collector of the driver transistor. And it was doing that intermittently sometimes, and then over time, it started. It just went completely dead. I'm not really that familiar with the kind of failure modes in BJT transistors. How do these things go bad? What's going on? I mean, I know how tubes go bad. All kinds of things happen to tubes. But what happens to transistors, and how frequently does this happen? I mean, I've had rigs where it would just be unthinkable that one of those transistors would kind of just give up the ghost on you. But that's apparently what happened here with Q11. When I was doing some Google searching as I was troubleshooting, there seemed to be a number of other messages in there about problems with Q11 and HW8s. So I'm thinking this is not a unique problem. But if anybody has any ideas on why this kind of problem would happen with a PNP transistor, let me know. Now, I'm not complaining. I'm delighted that it happened because, it gave me the chance to fix the rig. So no complaints here, but I'm just kind of interested in why this would happen. Anyway, the station is set up. I'm going to take a picture of it and put it on the web. But I think it's a really, really neat station. I'm very happy with it. Of course, the HW8 is the core. I have a little Radio Shack speaker next to it, and the HW8's audio amplifier fills the little room here with that speaker with audio with no problem. But I also have a pair of really old-fashioned cans. These are real old-fashioned headphones. God, they're ancient. We must be talking 1920s, 1930s here. They're high impedance, which is good because that's the audio output of the HW8 is a high impedance output. I think it's looking for about 1,000 ohms. I had to put a little audio transformer in between my Radio Shack speaker and the audio output of the HW8, which was fun too. Again, another bit of soldering here in the process. But I also have my cans here. They're very sensitive. They're so sensitive that I really have to keep the audio gain of the HW8 all the way down to almost nothing to avoid the audio output getting too loud for me. So I have these beautiful headphones sitting there. And I just like leaving them there next to the rig. They look really really great, really old radio. My key, I'm still a straight key guy. I have never made the leap to keyers, and I have an old, it looks like a J38, but it's not. It's one of these kind of fake J38s, but the same kind of design. And I have it mounted on the base of a Vibraplex bug. At one point, early in my ham radio career, I went out and bought a Vibraplex. And I never mastered it. I never really got good at it. And over the years and over many moves, the Vibraplex just deteriorated. You know, they're very complicated things. The little bits and pieces of it fell off. And so finally, I completely disassembled the thing and just used the base to hold my straight key. So I've got a straight key on a base. Parts of that Vibraplex bugger are still being used in the Dominican Republic by Gustavo Hotel India 8 Golf, who needed a few pieces to repair a Vibraplex that had been given to him by the famous contester Fred Lau. Anyway, so my Vibraplex keyer lives on here in Rome and in the Dominican Republic. The tuner I told you about, it's just a simple, I guess the circuit, you'd call it just a kind of an L network with an additional cap. And it's built on a piece of PC board. I've got it behind the key at the back of the operating bench. The operating bench, of course, is the packing crate that I told you about earlier. And one of the improvements I want to bring to the station. Oh, anyway, by the way, using this using the Homebrew antenna tuner also. A key part of the pleasure of using the station, there is a bit of homebrew gear involved. Not only is the antenna homebrew, yeah, of course, but we got the tuner is homebrew, and the recently repaired HW8 is there. Power in the HW8, I'm ashamed to admit, with commercial power, I've got a little 5-amp power supply. Bit of overkill there. The HW8 is not going to be drawing 5 amps, but there it is. And one of the things I want to do is I want to get back to solar power. I accidentally let my battery drain down, and so I think I'm going to go up on the roof with the Volkswagen solar panels and the 12 amp hour gel cell, charge that thing up, and then I'll be QRP solar powered 30 gauge wire. There's a certain symmetry to all this, you know. Running an HW8 to an enormous log periodic antenna, it just doesn't seem symmetrical to me. But running the HW8 to a bit of 30-gauge wire that's too small to even see, and it's just sort of hanging out the window, and that is producing contacts. There's a certain symmetry to that. And then running the whole thing off solar power, it just all seems to fit. You know what I mean? So anyway, I'm really delighted to be back into the world of true QRP. I'm sure the QRP community will understand what I'm talking about in describing the pleasures of using this rig. And as soon as I get done here with this sort of recording this morning, I'm going to try to get at least one contact. I think I find it quite nice to have at least one contact in the morning before I head off to work. And to me, I mean, it doesn't matter whether the guy is down the road or somewhere else in Europe. I mean, it would be great to work around the world with this thing. I'm going to make some improvements in the antenna, so things might get better. But as we approach solar minimum, I'm just really, really pleased to work just about anybody with this thing. So that's great. Okay, what else? Oh, one other project on the horizon. I've got my Drake 2B here on the shelf, and I've decided that after all these years, it's time to retube it. So I just went out. I pulled out the manual. I went to the Antique Electronic Supply website, and I just started clicking on the tubes that I need, and I ordered a complete set of new tubes for the Drake 2B, and I'm going to work on this rig. As soon as the tubes come, I'm going to retube it with new tubes, and I might venture into the fascinating world of alignment. I don't think I have to restring it. I put new string in there a while back. You know, you're getting a lot of use out of your Drake 2B when you have to change the dial string many times. And I've changed the dial string on this thing probably about 5 times. I'm actually getting good at it. You know, you're using an old radio when your radio has a string in it. And you know you're using it a lot when you've changed the string many times. Anyway, so that's the other project on the horizon. Let's see, what's next? I'm looking at my list. I always have a list here. Oh, yeah, I was going to ask about what you guys thought would be the best band for early morning radio, but I've kind of answered my own question, and I think it's 80 meters. So I want to put out an appeal, especially to stations in Europe, or kind of within range here of, I guess we're doing NVIS at this point, but let's try to get some QRP activity on the QRP frequency. I think it's 3560, if I'm not mistaken, on the 80 meter band. And I think it would be great if any of you guys are up early in the morning and want to point your log periodic antennas or your 30-gauge wire antennas at Rome. We could try to have some QRP QSOs here in the morning. Even early in the morning, I've been making contacts with stations all over Europe, so it should be possible. And let's try to get some contacts here going on 80 meters. That's where I'm going to be hanging out on 80 meters here in the morning. And I'm in the shack from 0400 UTC, especially during the work week before I go to work. That'd be great. Let's see what else. I've been following with great interest the nanowatt and microwatt adventures of Michael Alfalfa 1 Tango Juliet, the poet laureate of the QRP world. Michael's been doing really great stuff there, and I really recommend that you take a look at his website for his tunnel diode stations, and he's now moved to a Zener diode station with an FET power amplifier. He's got a beacon going, and he puts kind of code words in the beacon, and you have to, if you can receive it, you send in the code word, and I guess you get certification and the esteem of the amateur radio community. I think Michael's code words have all been very creative, and I want to mention that Michael, your code word there I can reveal it now because it's been a while, but Bethlehem, which came from the Arthur C. Clarke short story, The Star. I left The Star on the computer screen here, and Billy came in and found it and read it and really was taken by the writing of Arthur C. Clarke. So yesterday at the at work, we have a little office where people leave paperbacks as they depart from Rome, and they don't want to carry all their old paperbacks with them, and there's a kind of a lender's library there. And I said to myself, I bet you there's some Arthur C. Clarke in there somewhere. And it only took me about 5 minutes of rummaging through the books, and there it was, 2001 Space Odyssey. So Billy is deep into it now, and that's the result of the Alpha Alpha 1 Tango Juliet tunnel diode beacon from Vermont. It's amazing the reach of that little transmitter. Fine business, Mike. Keep up the good work. I've made a suggestion. I think Michael needs to add another diode to the mix, and I think he should set it up so that his Zener and tunnel diode transmitters are powered by solar panels. And perhaps after all the experiment is over, all the experimenting is over, and it becomes more of a kind of a regular beacon, just leave it out there with the solar panel and let the sun turn it on and run it, and then have the thing shut down when the sun goes down. I think that'd be great fun. I got some. We'll save that for. Let me see. I don't want to get into the mailbag quite yet. Not time for the gong yet. Ah, got to follow up on something here. In the last episode, I had talked about the Marconi's huge capacitor building, actually a building for his capacitor, because he was trying to tune, I think, at a frequency of 45 kilohertz, and he needed a capacitor, and he built one that was really of gargantuan proportions. And it struck me that the value cited in David Jensen's book, Early Radio, it just struck me as really low. It seemed like Marconi had gone to a heck of a lot of trouble to get 1.7 microfarads. So I gave the dimensions of the capacitor and asked some of the more mathematically inclined listeners to do the calculations. And I've got numerous reports from all around the world, thanks to everybody, and everyone confirms that Jensen was correct, and that Marconi was looking for more or less 1.7 microfarads. I think M0 Kilo Hotel Zulu was the first to come in with that calculation. Thanks to you, old man, and thanks to everyone else who did the math for us there. Wow, that's a long way to go. I guess the real parameter that was driving that thing was the voltage parameter. I guess he needed something that would take a lot of voltage, and I think he needed air dielectric because he was tired of changing the glass plates that he had previously used. So anyway, that's when you want to use air as the dielectric and you want real, real high voltage, I guess you end up building a separate building for your tuning capacitor. No need for that here at here with the HW8. Good thing my two capacitors are both kind of thumb-sized. Let's see. Kevin M0 Kilo Hotel Zulu is also working with a new double-sided PC board technique. Very, very interesting. I thought I'd mention that. Let's see. What else? Well, cluster map. I wanted to mention this. The little cluster map that we have up on the Gadgeteer News website. I'm fascinated by this thing. You guys might be tired of hearing me talk about it, but I kind of like to get up in the morning and take a look at what new dots are on the map. So I'm going to give a shout out to some of the new red dots that have appeared on our map. We have apparently numerous listeners out there in Alice Springs, Australia. So here's a big hello to Alice Springs. We've got a red dot in Egypt. Somebody is listening in Egypt. It doesn't look like Cairo. It might be Cairo. Probably is Cairo. But hello to our listeners there. Happy to have you aboard. And I mentioned last week that we have a red dot over Beijing. Hello to our Chinese listeners. Glad to have you with us. And a new dot has appeared over Juneau, Alaska. And hello to the listeners in Juneau. I think that is time now for, yes indeed, cue the sound effect.
Solder Smoke Mailbag.
I love them.
Yeah, awesome. Solder Smoke Mailbag. A lot of mail coming in here this week. Jorge Luis, KA4SGU, has written in, and he wanted to correct me on my my quote about turtles and Richard Feynman and the structure of the universe. And I thought that the story involved Feynman, but it didn't. Apparently, it involved Bertrand Russell, and Bertrand Russell was giving a lecture in which he was describing the structure of the universe, and an old lady in the crowd stuck her hand up and told Bertrand Russell that he got it all wrong, and that the earth was supported on the back of a very large turtle. And Russell thought he got her, and he said, "Okay, well, what's holding up the turtle?" And she looked at him like he was some sort of idiot and said, "Well, it's just more turtles, 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 turtles all the way down." So... All right, that's our cosmological comment for the morning. Somebody sent, and I don't have the email here in front of me, I apologize, but somebody very kindly sent in a book review for a new book called Crystal Clear, and it describes the important role played by crystals in World War II. They suddenly found themselves with the need for very, very strict and accurate frequency control so that they could run radio nets involving stations and airplanes and ships at sea with wildly varying temperature and atmospheric conditions. Obviously, LC tuned circuits weren't going to do it, so we had the birth of on a massive scale of crystals. I think many of us still have some of these World War II crystals floating around in our junk boxes. Anyway, the new book describes the development of crystals for frequency control in radio. Of course, this is something very important to us. I just was reading somewhere that the crystal control requirement for novices in ham radio ended in 1972. I came on the air in 1973, so I just missed this happy rockbound condition. Anyway, but I remember all kinds of talk about it and efforts to avoid it and to get a little bit of wiggle when you were using the crystal. One of the things I read about on QRPL this morning, I hadn't heard this one before. Guy talked about how when he was a rockbound novice, he actually drilled a hole in the case of the I guess it was the 80 meter crystal that he was using, and he put a little screw in there, and by tightening the screw slightly, he could increase or decrease the pressure between the plates and the crystal and get a little bit of frequency variation. I hadn't heard that one before. That's a good one. I've heard about penning the crystals. You know, you could open it up and put a little bit of additional carbon on there and move it, but you know, not that really doesn't make it variable, but this guy, the screw through the case of the FT-243 crystal holder as a means of varying the frequency. Well, that's a good one. I like that. I had never tried that, but congrats to the guy who did, and very, very, very innovative. All right. Let's see. Some other mail we got here. I'm going to try to pull up the mail screen here. So, yeah, this might be, I'm on the wrong page. So anybody I missed this week, I'll get to you next week. We've got a really nice reference to a YouTube page. Randy, K7AGE, produced a video of his reception of the HARP 6.9 megahertz moon bounce signals. And a couple weeks ago, we presented a recording of this. Randy's got a video of the action in his shack at the time that this experiment took place. So check out the video. I have it on the Gadgeteer News webpage, and there's a link to the video there. I really recommend it. Pete, W6JFR, sent in a real nice email telling me of some Italian ham technology developments and some very fine business ham radio operators in Italy who are producing some kits and pieces of equipment that look really, really good. Thanks for that, Pete. Ramakrishnan, our man in Bangalore, writes in. He's VU3RDD, and he sends a message pointing to a video on Tesla and noting that Nikola Tesla definitely had the knack. He did indeed, and it made me think about other knack victims. Tesla had the knack, definitely. Marconi, definite knack victim, definite. So thanks for reminding us of that, Ramakrishnan. I think one of my favorite emails of the week came from John, Kilo 7 Juliet Mike, out there in Montana. And John described where he was when he listened to the last episode of Solder Smoke. You'll recall that was the episode that was recorded during the thunderstorm here in Rome. And apparently the thunder was quite audible. John said that he was riding through Montana, riding along the Gallatin River in Montana, looking at a new snowfall, white water rushing past snow-covered boulders. He described a really beautiful scene. And then added to the mix was the sound in his car over the MP3 player of lightning bolts and thunder in Rome, Italy. So he said it seemed to fit. He described how he came around the corner and even saw a large bull moose sitting there, standing there looking at him. So I really got a kick out of that, to think that somebody was riding through the snow along the Gallatin River in Montana listening to thunder in Rome, Italy. Fine business, John. John admits that he is another victim of the knack and describes some fairly typical symptoms. We've seen this before, John. Everything you've described is part of the symptomology, and we just have to tell you that there is no cure, but Solder Smoke will help you deal with the symptoms. Hang in there, old man. Who else? What else we got here? I'm looking through the list. Okay. I wanted to mention this. I got a nice email from Mike KL7R's wife, Jackie. She says she's doing fine. She notes that when she wrote in, there's lots of beautiful new snow. Juneau is colder than normal. She asked me to say hello to everybody, and she said something that I didn't know. Mike might have told me this, but she said that he was always very interested in foreign languages. I knew he spoke Spanish. We spoke in Spanish every once in a while. His Spanish was quite good. But she said that he got interested in foreign languages because when he was in college, he lived in the foreign language dorm with the foreign students, which I think is very much Mike. Probably was tied in with his interest in ham radio and DX. It all fits together. So thanks to Jackie for that nice email, and glad to hear that you're doing okay. Which now brings us to part two of our discussion with our correspondent in Dubai, Ron Sparks, Alpha Golf 5 Radio Sierra. Ron and I had a real nice talk, and I'll put part two of the conversation on right now. So here we go to the Echolink conversation with AG5RS.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and you know, Dilbert has a lot to say about this. Well, you mentioned, you know, I guess, you know, everybody else is going to be out there saying, "Yep, I did the same thing." In my case, it was the TV repair shop, kind of on, I know where exactly where it is, on Kings Highway in Valley Cottage, New York. It was a little, almost literally a Radio Shack kind of building. Just one shop, one store, one building, and it was the TV repair shop. And you went in there and you saw behind the counter just this, for me, very, very interesting, huge collection of replacement tubes and the soldering irons and the scopes and everything back in there. And so we would, every time we went into town to get some groceries or something, I would convince my parents to take me into the TV repair shop. And he must have had other victims of the knack coming in there, but I didn't get as far as becoming the assistant TV repairman like you did. Ron, that's great. But in my case, there was another very similar building in town, and it had on the front the call sign W2DMC, and the great title of the club was the Crystal Radio Club, and this became known to our family as the Radio Shack, and every time we drove past it, all the kids would chime in, "There's the Radio Shack," and so it was kind of in our field of view there for a few years before I got up the gumption to go and try to join up. I remember my father drove me over there the night of the meeting, and I chickened out. I must have been about 12 or 13, and I he was waiting for me out there in the street, and I walked in, and I got shy, and I came back to the car, and I said, "Oh no, I don't want to go." And my father said, "Come on," and he took me in, and he didn't know anything about it. He was not interested in electronics at all, but he knew I was, and he took me in there, and he introduced me to the guys, and he basically said to them, "You know, this kid has the knack. Can you help him?" AG5RS M0HBR.
I think that's probably one of the secrets of people who learn to deal with the knack over the years, is that they have parents that are understanding. I think you pretty much described my father. He was forever carrying me around town to different places that had radio and electronic stuff available so that I could satisfy my urges and learn the knack. And he was very tolerant. I guess I'm really a fairly recent ham. I have only been licensed for a little over 10 years. I've gone through one renewal cycle, I guess, and the reason for that is kind of interesting to me, at least. I started trying to become a ham back in the 60s, and have since come to know that the time I started looking was about the time that incentive licensing had knocked off a bunch of folks, and in the small West Texas town where I grew up, there was not a lot of
M0HBR, M0NDE
interest, and certainly it was hard to find if there was any. So I didn't ever understand the way that you could get a novice license through local ham radio operators, because there just weren't any. So when I investigated, the nearest place to get the FCC exam was in Fort Worth, which was about a 300-mile drive from my home. And it was only held on a Wednesday, so my father would have had to have taken off work, rented a motel room, and driven us all the way up and back in order for me to take the test with no particular guarantee that I was going to be truly successful at the age of 10. So that just never happened, and I sort of satisfied myself with a lot of kit building and shortwave listening and investigations into mystical boxes and small tubes and cans of things that had exciting properties, like being able to mix two signals or count down something. I don't have quite as good a fond memory of old boat anchors as most hands do because of that. But boy, I do remember having a true desire for one of those Syncor Magic Eye component analyzers. M0HBR, this is HE5RS.
HE5RS, M0HBR. Yeah, you know, I guess that the distance to the test center really probably knocked a lot of guys out. And I know a lot of people complained when they went to the kind of voluntary examiner kind of thing. But I guess it works. I guess it serves the purpose. And, yeah, it's a shame that kids would be, you know, kept out of it because of distance from the FCC office. And in my case, we were close by. It was we had to go to the FCC office in Manhattan. We were about 30 miles away. And when it kind of came time for me to take my general class exam, I guess I was 14 years old. I had gotten the novice ticket from my my Elmer, WB2NEC, Hilmar, great guy. And it came time for my dad to take me down to take the exam. He only had 1 year, so the clock was ticking, and the pressure was on. And my dad drove me down to the FCC office in New York and got me into the building. And I can still remember it. I can remember what the office was like. I remember they set you down in this kind of a student, like an elementary school student desk. It was a combination seat, and then the kind of the writing table came up around you, and you had to kind of squeeze your way into it. And you did the code test first, and man, I got past the 13 words a minute, and I was just elated. That was great. And then on to the theory, and I got past that, and I'm telling you, and that was a feeling of accomplishment, Ron. A lot of times when they talk about dumbing down and whether they should make the licenses easier to attract more people, I always say that I think that the fact that it was hard was the attraction. I mean, the fact that it was an achievement, the fact that it was, you know, it was something that was difficult for adults to do. And to be able to do it and get the license at that age was a great thing. Gene Shepard, K2ORS, he had a different call at the time. He was a W9, but he's the author, and he had the radio show in New York for many years. But in one of his talks on ham radio, he talks about the same thing, about how when he got his license as a teenager, I guess he's about the same age as I was, he said that he immediately considered himself, I forget what his call was at the time, W9GRS, a man of substance. I did too. I thought it was sort of like having PhD after your name or something like that. Great stuff. Oh, you mentioned mixers. That's that might pull us back into the mystery of the mysterious land of mixers, AG5RS, M0HBR.
Yeah, that's a great feeling when you pass your first ticket. I remember that very well, because to me it was probably the end of about 25 years of desire, and finally got around to it and got that first ticket. And technician class or not, I was excited. That was great fun. And then my very first contact was with a ham in Sweden, and I can't remember his call sign. We were on the road to a HamCom convention in Dallas and used one of my friend's 10-meter mobile. Picked up the ham in Sweden, and it was like being a kid all over again. I was really driven by that. And that one thing led to another in that regard, and that particular ham fest, I made a number of friends with some of the folks in the microwave community, and that's where all of a sudden mixers become really exciting, because you get mixers at HF, and that's one thing, but then when you've got all these strange little circles and arrows and triangles on a printed circuit board, and none of them connect to each other, and somebody tells you that that's a two-port circulator, and that all the RF from one frequency goes one direction, and all the RF from another one goes another direction, and to tune it, you take a small magnet and move it around, that gets truly mystical. But a lot of fun. AG5RS, M0HBR. Thank you.
AG5RS, M0HBR. Oh, man. My head hurts, Ron, just thinking about the microwave stuff. We'll have to talk some more about mixers. But first, all this talk about getting on the air and clandestine antennas, I want to pick your brain here a bit on stealth. I might have told you we're living in an apartment house. And we're real close to the center of Rome. I mean, I can see the bits of the Vatican from the window. I can see some of the major monuments. I can see all the way across Rome from right out the window. So we're right in the center. And in the center, you don't get a lot of space. And the population density here is really high. And the apartment house, I could tell that they're kind of finicky here, and I don't think my log periodic antenna up on the roof would endear me with the neighbors. But so actually, my plan is to come up with something that's going to not raise a single eyebrow, something that won't even be noticed. Now, I had thought that there are a number of antennas up on the roof. We're on the fourth floor. There's two other apartments above us, and then the roof. And on the roof, there's kind of one common use VHF, UHF, TV antenna. There's one VHF, UHF, TV antenna that has seen better days and is no longer connected to anything. And there's two or three satellite dishes up there. One of them seems to be for one of the apartments. The other one seems to be common use. Now, they've got, obviously, got some sort of pipe coming down here to the apartments that's been thoroughly stuffed with coaxial cables. It doesn't seem to be any room in there at all. So I had originally thought about, well, maybe I'll take one of those coax cables coming down from the roof to the apartment, and instead of using it for the TV, I'll just use that for my antenna purposes. That would take care of getting the feed line up to whatever antenna I get up on the roof, but doing that's going to raise some eyebrows, because it's going to require me to go and mess about with the antenna, possibly knocking other people's off the reception off, a bad way to start. So I kind of scrapped that idea. It's just too complicated. Now, my backup plan is this, to just put a piece of wire up on the roof. I mean, fantastic views of the horizon in all directions up there. Now, there's a place on the roof where I could just put a long bit of wire, lay it just right up on the roof. It'll be on the surface. There's a place there where I could put it. It'd be laying on top of a bit of concrete. Nobody would even see it. And then from one end of it, I could drop down to the apartment without crossing any windows, a very, very thin bit of magnet wire that's about the same color as the side of the building. Now, you'd have to be really an eagle eye even to see this thing. That would be the connection between the wire up on the roof and my window, where I could put in a little tuner and then on to the HW8 and the DXCC on a roll. What do you think, Ron? The AG5RS M0HBR.
Yeah, that sounds a good plan. I think I would make a couple of changes that might improve things a little bit. One thing I've had really good luck with there, you can get it in the States from any of the major wire companies, like the Wireman or several others that I've dealt with, is a small antenna wire we sort of all in Houston lovingly called spider wire. It's a black jacketed copper, steel-clad copper, or vice versa, copper-clad steel. But it's only about 26 gauge, I believe, altogether. So you buy a couple of hundred feet of that stuff, and then the first thing you do is you take it out, lay it down on a piece of the newspaper somewhere, and take three different cans of spray paint, one sort of pale blue, one gray, and then depending on whether you're in a tree area or not, like in your place, you might use either brown or green. And then just randomly spray it all over the coil of wire. Flip the coil over and spray it again in random patterns. Then when you stretch that stuff out, I guarantee even if you are an eagle eye, you're going to have a hard time seeing it. So that would be the direction I would go. And then I would actually elevate the wire slightly off the roof by, you know, if you've got any kind of parapets or anything connected across, and people aren't going to see it, and if they see it, it's just going to be a little wire up there. The second thing I would do is I would actually go with a balanced arrangement. I'd make a V out of the wire, and then I would use some inexpensive 300-ohm twin lead to bring the signal down the side of the building, and, you know, maybe they would see it, but they'd just think it's a TV antenna connection. Some of that twin lead, you could do the same thing with the paint. Just take it and gently spray it in random patterns, and it really camouflages well, and most people don't get upset if they see TV twin lead. Then you could tune it off on the balanced end inside, and probably, depending on the dimensions on the roof, you might could do pretty good. I know a friend of mine used a similar arrangement in his neighborhood and ran basically a sort of an inverted V that was long enough that he was getting good reception all the way down to 80 meters on it. So he was pleased with that. But I think the trick is, you know, be concerned, but I would, you know, if somebody asks what you're doing, just say you're putting up an antenna to listen to radio or FM. And at least in the U.S., that seems to work pretty well. M0HBR, this is AG5RS.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Ron, and we'll see you with part three next week. Thanks to everybody who's tuned in. Keep those cards and letters and emails coming our way. Always delighted to receive them. And glad to know that folks are listening to Solder Smoke. Good luck with all your projects. Good DX, good QRP. And good luck with that 30-gauge wire. Don't worry about it. If it falls down, you just throw up another one. 7-3 from Rome.